Hey everyone, this is Dan Benjamin. I'm the host of this show and a handful of others here on 5x5. I want to take a second to say thank you for listening. It's because of you that I'm able to do this full time. All of 5x5's podcasts are and will remain free, and although we have sponsors to help with expenses, there are still some big costs associated with making these shows. I really want to expand the network by bringing in new shows, new hosts, doing more live shows, and eventually hire somebody part-time to help me with production before it kills me. So this is where 5x5 membership can really make a difference. You can directly help support 5x5 and your favorite shows by becoming a member and get a cool t-shirt in the process. Go to members.5x5.tv to learn more. And thanks. This is The Big Web Show, a live talk show about the web and the future of web publishing. I'm Dan Benjamin, and I'm joined today by my co-host, Jeffrey Zeltman. This episode of The Big Web Show is sponsored by MailChimp, powerful email marketing. MailChimp serves more than 300,000 users and 20 million emails daily, and their template language makes it dead simple to code HTML email templates that give your clients the ability to adjust colors, fonts, and more without breaking the layout or having to mess with your code. Sign up free and see why everyone is switching to MailChimp. Check them out at MailChimp.com. This is episode number 8 of The Big Web Show. I'm Dan Benjamin, joined as always by my co-host, Jeffrey Zeltman. Hey, Jeffrey.
Hello, Dan. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Can you please introduce our excellent and talented guest?
It will be my great pleasure. Whitney Hess is a senior experience designer, people we used to call IAs, but so much more. She is an inventor. Right, you have a patent. You share a patent with American Express.
Yes, I am named on a patent. It is not solely my own, but I am named on it. I can tell you all about it.
See, that's awesome. I'm not named on any patent. I'm named on patent infringements, but I'm not named on any patents. And she is a web consultant, web designer. User experience designer, IA, all that good stuff for freelance and HappyCog. And she's also, I believe, the most active Twitter user. Period.
That isn't fair.
No, I'm a very active Twitter user and people get sick of me, but you're remarkable. I mean, Whitney's constantly at conferences and tweets all the interesting things that are being said. Pretty much just, it's a stream. It's when they invented the word live streaming, they were thinking of you. So
I'm not a live streamer. Come on. I don't have like a camera over my shoulder everywhere I go. I'm not that bad. I'm not that bad. Right?
Just imagine if Robert Scoble was very pretty and about 30 years younger. That's all
Holy
I'm saying.
Holy crap. You're comparing me to Scoble? At the beginning of the conversation, that's not a good move.
That might be the end of the conversation. We love Robert Scoble. Come on. It's a compliment in a way.
So user experience, huh?
Crickets.
User experience. You know, okay, so I picked up on Twitter, I think, January 2008. I was bored one night and I knew of one person that was using Twitter. I'd heard of this thing and I didn't quite know what it was, so I thought I would sign up. And the person that I knew that was on there was David Armano, who I'd worked with previously when I was at Digitas. And I added him as a friend and went to sleep and didn't think much else about it. And then when I woke up in the morning, I had 30 people following me and all these emails in my inbox telling me such and such is in your new follower, which I didn't even understand what it meant at the time. But right. One of those people was Jared Spool. That's when I realized, wow, there might be something to this. So, yes, Twitter has been a very useful tool for me in my career so far.
What was your first tweet?
It was something along the lines of trying to expand my professional network. That's what I was thinking about.
See, that's an entirely appropriate tweet for you, and that's good. Mine was scratching. I just wrote scratching. So had no idea when I started with Twitter that I was going to like it as much as I did. And what do you mean by it's been good for your career? Can you explain that a little bit?
Well,
because not everyone can do research in wireframes, but everyone can tweet. So how can they
certainly?
How can they use it to help them?
Well, I didn't quite know what the effects of it were going to be, but when I started out, I knew that there were people there for professional purposes. And certainly as more people have jumped on the bandwagon, the tenor of the conversation has changed. But early 2008, none of my friends had heard of Twitter, but a lot of people that were working in the user experience community or in the broader business and tech communities were using it or were thinking about using it. And so it was a way for me to reach people that I would have absolutely no access to otherwise. And Jared Spool's a perfect example. So here's somebody whose writing I had been reading when I was in college. I mean, he was the highest level of authority in my mind. And all that happens is one person who I know from a previous job sends a tweet saying, hey, you should follow Whitney Hess. She just joined Twitter. And suddenly Jared Spool wants to know what I have to say. It just completely leveled the playing field. And it gave me, as a very young person, a very inexperienced person in the community, the opportunity to get the attention of the most experienced people. And I mean, as a result, I formed a friendship with him. He's a mentor to me in many ways. I've gone to a bunch of his conferences. I see him all over the place. I mean, it's like he's one example, and I'm using him as an example because he was your previous guest and his face is staring back at me on the website. But that's just one of many people who, you know, have inspired me and opened the doors for me in ways that I don't think I would have been able to do for myself had I not had Twitter as a tool to reach them.
That's interesting. Now, that was the promise of blogging as well, right? That, I mean, even before it was called blogging, anyone could have a website and that kind of leveled the playing field. But Twitter seems to have be quicker at this. Maybe there's less in, you know, I go to, I'm following Twitter on Twitterific on my iPad. I'm not really going to Whitney Hess's site necessarily. It doesn't mean that I don't go to it sometimes, but like I don't have to go to Jeffrey Zeldman's site. I don't have to go to whoever's site. I can just, they're in my Twitter stream. So it sort of lowers the
investment. It's RSS in 140 characters. I mean, what RSS promised me it was going to do for my blog is bring my blog to where people are already playing and not having to have them come to me. You know, it achieved because I think that with messages that are so short, there's just low risk in following somebody. And you don't have to sit through, you know, their three-page diatribe on such and such topic. You can just quickly read something in under 5 seconds and be on to the next person. And I mean, I had tried blogging. It's not like the technology role was new to me.
You blog at Pleasure and Pain.
Yeah, well, Pleasure and Pain was post-Twitter. And I had had other blogs since, you know, I was in college, since like maybe 2001, 2002. I had been starting blogs, but I was the only one reading them. And Twitter suddenly became a way that I could find an audience and then send them to my blog. And the blog became a place where I was expanding on things that I was talking about in short on Twitter. And I mean, I just never expected any of the outcome that I got in just deciding to sign up for a Twitter account. But it completely has transformed everything.
You know, Whitney, it almost seems to me like blogs are more the place you go when you want to write more than 100, and not just you specifically, but anybody, where you go to when you want to do something that's more than 140 characters.
Yeah.
And it used to be that was the main place you go, and Twitter was almost for these little short, quick conversations and thoughts, and now it's almost flip-flop. Like, oh,
absolutely,
I had more to say about this one topic, please go to my blog, which people are going to go to from Twitter.
Yeah.
Unless you're John Gruber. That's very true. Unless you're John Gruber or Jim Crudell.
Right.
Because they publish essentially tweets on their blogs in addition to, I mean, in Gruber's case especially, he'll publish long content and then he'll publish a link.
Right.
And I've started doing that, but it's weird. When I'll alternate. myself. I'll say, I'm going to just push this link out on Twitter and see what happens. Or I'll go, I'm going to push this link out on Zeldman.com with an image and see what happens. And, you know, the jury's out. I don't really know which gets more traffic or anything like that yet. But it's very interesting the way we sort of willingly hand off our own personal traffic, hand our traffic to Twitter in return for this different conversation that we get to have, and maybe in return for, you know, instant stats on your audience. I mean, mm-hmm. you know when people are responding right away. It's much more. And how would you say it's helped your career? Besides Happy Cog, I know you do a lot of other. I mean, I know you've worked on Boxy, is that other high profile projects, which some of which you can talk about.
Yeah, I can talk about pretty much all of them.
Okay.
I'm happy to. But yeah, Twitter has had an impact on my career on the larger scale than just, you know, getting to meet great people, because those great people then tell other great people about me, and ultimately that leads to referrals for gigs. So part of what I've tried to do with Twitter is just make sure that I'm top of mind. I'm very clear that I'm a user experience designer on Twitter. I tweet about UX related stuff fairly frequently, but I also tweet about stuff that shows my personality. And the people that follow me think of me among the first group of people when they think of user experience designers. So whenever an opportunity comes up, I'm one of the first people that they think of. And that's not because I'm the most experienced or I'm the smartest or I'm the best designer by any means, because I'm none of those things, but because they consider me in a way to be a known entity, because my face flashes across their computer screen many times a day. So whether they know me or not, they feel like they can trust me. And I think because Twitter has kind of created this like semi-public persona, it means that it's not just credibility, but I have culpability. And if I were to really screw something up, it would be publicly known, I suppose. So I think that there's like a safety aspect in that as well. So I got the Boxy gig via Twitter. I had been chatting with someone that, you know, I had met via Twitter, Charlie O'Donnell, who is kind of a fixture in the New York tech community. His mentor and former boss, Fred Wilson, is a VC, and he was tweeting that he was looking for a user experience designer for one of his portfolio companies. Charlie forwarded his info to me, and the company was Boxy. And so had it not been for Twitter, I wouldn't have gotten that gig. And that gig, you know, was very high profile in my mind. So that was awesome.
Yeah. Well, the Twitter connectedness reminds me of the early days of the web, which I'm sure Dan can remember as well. And for instance, I had a friend, Lee Baker Foley. I made friends with her over the web because we liked each other's websites, and she ended up visiting and staying with me. And this was like a stranger from Ireland, but she didn't feel like a stranger to me because we'd exchange a bunch of jokes and laughs, and we'd seen each other's pictures, and we'd seen each other's work. And Derek Pawlik, same thing, was a web friend before he was a friend. And I feel like the same thing happens on Twitter now, and it's really fun. And I think it had gone out of the web in a way.
I never found that community. Like, I wherever you all were hanging out, I don't know if I was just too young or if I was in the wrong places, but I had blogs and I couldn't find other blogs, and I couldn't find ways to get people to come to my blog. I felt totally siloed. I was like within the four walls of my blog design, and I didn't know where people were hanging out or exchanging this info, and Twitter just became a very clear sandbox to play in.
So if someone is listening to this and they've got a blog that's not very popular, and they're good at their job, but they feel like not enough people know about them, they're not getting enough gigs, what is the value that you bring to Twitter that makes people, I hate to use that phrase value, but you know what I'm saying. I mean, if you just retweet other people, I don't think that's going to help your career at all.
Right.
I know Whitney, you are constantly making observations, commenting on other people's articles, commenting on things that you've heard that were smart or interesting. And I think people follow you. It's sort of like having a little, almost like the CNN crawl in a way. It's like, I don't have time to read web. I can't read user experience magazines all day long, but I can glance at Twitter every now and then. And when I glance at something from Whitney, it's probably going to be a useful, helpful comment in something useful in my field.
I appreciate you saying that. Sometimes I check myself and I say, am I sending stuff that people actually care about? Am I sending enough? Am I not being user experience enough? I mean, I think that just as human beings, we're always judging ourselves and wondering, you know, how other people perceive us. But I didn't really have a strategy going into this. I saw Jeff Patton, who is kind of the guru of all things agile meets UX, based in Salt Lake City. And I saw him at UX London in May when I was there. And he said to me, he's like, how did you use Twitter to do all this stuff? Or how did you get people to your blog? And what was your strategy? And I said, I didn't have one, but it all happened. And I've been asked so many times, what's your strategy, that I kind of had to reverse engineer it to figure out what it was that I did that happened to work. All that I can really figure out is that I showed my personality, I linked to people that inspired me, and I am not all business all the time. And I think that more than anything, people want to work with people that they like and people that they feel have the resources to learn, not necessarily that are already the brightest people in the room. And I follow people that have tremendous insights and are always saying witty things or just provide me with so much relevant information. And I don't feel like I'm that same kind of person. I'm not like a genius synthesist, or I'm not a genius anything. I just am a regular person. I don't pretend to be something that I'm not. And hopefully that's what comes across. And that's really what I would recommend to people that they do. Find the people that inspire you, get involved in the conversations that they're having, share what you know. Like, don't keep that information hostage because you think it's going to make you smarter, but just, you know, let it free and be yourself. And it's cheesy stuff, but I don't know how else to really describe what it is that I've done that's worked.
This is okay. I think we should actually talk about work, but I just want to summarize a little bit. I think that you've made some really good points about personality and identity and how that makes people feel comfortable with you or like you. I think you're too modest when you talk about, you know, not being a genius or whatever. I think you're really great. I mean, I've seen you talk to clients, I've seen you do research, and I think you're very, 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 very smart and really good at synthesizing information and reconciling different points of view in ways that are strategic and tactful and make people feel included and like they're being listened to, even when what they want is really contradictory to what someone else wants. I think you handle those kind of situations very well.
Wow. Thank you. That's the highest of compliments, because that's surely not what is going on inside my head.
Oh, I know.
But I think you also know. But I think that if anything, modesty comes from surrounding yourself with people who are better than you and smarter than you. And that's what I try to do every day. And so that's where I draw my inspiration from. And then I just try to push that back out to the people who follow me. And hopefully it just causes a chain reaction. And we all think that everyone else is smarter than us, and we're all getting smarter at the same time. So
I like that. You know, I'm going to tell you a little secret. I'm always telling people, well, I work with people who are smarter than me. I work with people who are more talented than me. And I'm secretly waiting for someone to contradict me. And they never do. They never do. You know, people will say, oh, this is fantastic, blah, blah, blah. And they'll always look, you know, I'll have this amazing team. They'll look at me like I had something to do with it, which I had something to do with it. And I'll just go, well, no, it's these wonderful people. And I wait for them to go, but it's really you. But they never do. So there we are.
Jeffrey, it's really
It's really you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Definitely
okay.
You.
It's not. Anyway, so let's talk a little bit about what it is that you do for and maybe what got you into it? I mean, you studied what? Computer science?
Yeah, I started off as a computer science nerd in high school, actually. My high school offered one computer science class. I took it my freshman year, and I liked it so much that I took it every other year of high school. I just kept taking the same class. Then I was encouraged to go to college for computer science, and I got into Carnegie Mellon, which I thought was a big coup because there, you know, was highly prestigious at the time, and I didn't think I had a chance to get in, and I did. And then 3 weeks in, I'm like, whoa, this is not what I want to be doing with my life. You know,
how did you discover user interaction, interactive design? How did you discover all that?
Because well,
that's not what they were teaching, was it?
Yeah, that's not what they were teaching in computer science. I was pretty miserable coding all day, and I was flipping through my college course directory kind of thing, and I was just looking at all the different departments, and I saw this thing that had, like, the little description said that it was a synthesis of computer science, design, psychology, and statistics. And it was called Human-Computer Interaction. And I'd never heard of it, but I met up with a friend who was actually in the program. And when he was telling me that they do field studies, they go out and they actually talk to people and figure out what they need. And then they write up those requirements and they design the product based on what people need. And then they work with computer scientists to build the thing. I thought, wait a minute. You mean, like, this is fixing the blinking 12 o'clock on the VCR? Like, it finally all kind of made sense what my interest in technology had always been, but the only avenue that I saw for being involved in a professional way was computer science. No one had told me that I could design the software and not build it. No one had told me that I could work with people. And, you know, had it not been for getting into Carnegie Mellon, I don't know that I would ever have discovered this field because it's just not widespread. I mean, in the past 5 or so years, it's becoming more well known. But even when I was in college, it was pretty much an unknown. And so I got my undergraduate, a double major in professional writing and human computer interaction. And then I stayed for my master's. And part of the agreement of getting a master's as opposed to a PhD is that you become involved in the professional sphere and you use the skills that you learn to help businesses. So I did some searches and I found out that HCI outside of academia is called user experience, and the rest is history.
Cool. You talk about working with people. A lot of people get into computers or get into design because they don't want to work with people. They want to isolate and live in be in a perfect cubicle and just make something perfect. And one of the frustrations, one of the great joys of design, but also one of the frustrations, is that you've got to deal with other people's input. So
yeah,
you create something and you think it's perfect, but the client doesn't. And maybe they're right. Maybe their insight's useful. Maybe even so, you don't like it. I mean, talk about working with people, because that's what you do all the time, really.
There are two sides of me. There's the me that people outside in the world see, which is an outgoing and caring person. I mean, I must be caring. I want to make stuff that people use, right? But then on the inside of me, there's that absolute loner. I want to stay in a room and make something perfect and not have anyone contradict me. So I think that having both aspects to my personality has actually made me better at this job, because I get to go out and interview people and understand where they're coming from, learn about their lives, get a sense for what isn't working and how we can make it better. And then I can convince the people that actually make the stuff why that's what they want to do. And I can appeal to that sensibility that they have of, you know, this is my art. And I feel like a lot of programmers are artists where they don't want people really infringing on their art because they are incredibly talented and they know how they want to achieve something. And it's ultimately my goal to convince them of why it's better for them to do it in this way that is more appealing or more useful for the user.
What makes you angry as a consultant?
What makes me angry?
Yeah.
Oh, my biggest pain point is spending the entirety of a project convincing my client of why they hired me in the first place. And I don't think that that is unique to user experience, but I think that because user experience is still an unknown for a lot of organizations, it's perhaps more prevalent. I get brought in by people sometimes that have heard the term and that know that they need it on their team, but don't fully understand the depth of the changes that I'm going to want to make. And oftentimes it's not the interface that needs fixing. It's the company itself. It's the processes that they follow or the attitudes that they have towards creating their product, not really the check boxes and the drop downs. So
do you have to address that? Is that become your job and your responsibility to try and change the way they work as a company?
Ultimately, that's my goal, but not everyone is hiring me for those purposes. So that can be hard. And I think people hire user experience designers often for very tactical purposes. Redesign this page. This search feature isn't working. We're losing people on this landing page. Help us figure out why and fix it. And that's the real tactic. But what they're not asking themselves oftentimes, which I then have to in turn ask for them, is why is this landing page important to you? Do people even need this landing page?
Right.
Do you even need a website? And then a lot of times I become like a therapist more than, you know, a house painter. I'm not really a house painter. I kind of come in wearing those clothes, but my intention is to have a much deeper impact than that.
It's funny, you reminded me of a story. Jeff Veen, who's been a guest on this show, he's the founder of Adaptive Path, and now of Typekit, and a bunch of other great stuff. One of the founders of Adaptive Path, brilliant guy. He talked about a challenge Adaptive Path had where this college hired them. This college had decided that their website should be a portal, right? So that anyone who'd gone to the college, it should be a portal to everything. So... But they found that people weren't really looking at the stock reports. They were spending money to put the stock market on their college website's front page. Mm-hmm. And then they found that users weren't spending enough time looking at their stocks. So they hired Adaptive Path. Like, you know, they were basically having problems like that. And Adaptive Path and Jeff Veen were saying, well, why do you want stock tips on your college homepage?
Yeah.
It doesn't make, you know, basically he was saying, let's get rid of all this stuff and let's figure out who's coming to the college, what they want to do, and let's help them do that. You know, but people do get these ideas in their heads. They want to be like Amazon, or they want to be like Google, or they want to be like who knows what. And then, so a lot of it is just talking. What about, here's another problem. People often say they want innovation, but then when they see it, it scares them and they want proof that it works.
Yeah, I have a saying, which is, how about we innovate by giving people what they actually want? So let's not create the next new fabulous, glossy, whatever the hell thing that doesn't exist anywhere else. There might be a very good reason for why it doesn't exist. And the thing with technology that's so complicated, and this is way beyond the sphere of user experience, but this is the technology industry in general. I think it goes outside of technology. Just because you can do something doesn't mean you should. And so much of my role is in using restraint in the right ways and encouraging companies to use restraint in order to create stuff that's actually going to impact people's lives. And by people, I mean users, but also the people within their own company or the stockholders or, you know, anyone, that it's actually going to have a long lasting impact that is helpful and creates progress in some way, but isn't just, you know, to win an award, because that doesn't really help anybody.
Well, yeah.
And oftentimes the sites that win awards are the ones that are used the least.
They're nice. Often they're nice advertising one-offs, and a lot of talent and creativity went into them, but nobody really cares. I mean, the sites, if we look at the sites that that we love on the web, it's like Twitter, because I can talk to my friends instantly and get feedback instantly. Flickr, because I can put family photos up and my friends mm-hmm. can say, your daughter's really cute. And I can go, mm-hmm. oh, isn't she? You know, I mean, what is that? It's all human communication. Or Amazon, because I can buy a book or a Barbie dream house or something, like, you know, and not go to the store. I mean, the stuff that we like is not super advanced with flying stuff and, you know.
Yeah, we're not building flying cars here, and I don't think we should. I think we should. There's a lot of problems out in the world. I mean, turn on the TV. They're facing you every day. Like, why aren't we addressing those problems? And that's why when I work with companies, I try so hard to not focus on the one thing, you know, the short-term goal of what they're trying to redesign, but I try to address the larger issues of what are you trying to achieve as a business, and who do you want your customers to be, and why, and how do we find those people, and how can we design something that actually appeals to those people, not necessarily the people you have today and not necessarily yourselves, but the people that will actually bring good business to the company or to people that you can actually have a real impact on. I mean, I think Brighter Planet is a great example of this, Jeffrey, the project that we worked on together.
Brighterplanet.com. I mean,
yeah, Brighterplanet.com. I think in a lot of ways, they expected this to be a product for tree huggers, like super environmentalist types, and that's who had their credit card before. I mean, not everyone would trade off airline miles for carbon offsets as their reward points on their credit card. People that really care about the environment would. And so that it was natural for them to assume that that's who their audience would be for a web app for helping people lower their carbon footprint. But based on a very small amount of research, we were able to see pretty quickly that they could have a much greater impact on the casual environmentalist than on the deep environmentalist, because the deep environmentalist already had a whole bunch of resources. They already had community that they were, you know, reaching out to and that they were collaborating with in order to do great things. And it was the casual environmentalist that doesn't. And that was a niche that they were able to fill, and that they could actually have significant impact on these people's lives with this essentially the same amount of effort from a production standpoint. You know, we could have made a website for the deep greens just as easily as we could have made a website for the casual environmentalists, but we had much greater impact on the latter.
Right. By casual environmentalists, you mean people like you and me, people who basically say, man, I feel guilty using these paper towels, but I've got to clean this ink off my floor. What should I do?
Yeah.
Right. People who want to make a difference, but also, or moms, you interviewed a lot of moms, right? The mommy bloggers, Nikki was this sort of prototype mommy blogger. But, you know, I don't really want to use paper diapers, but I've got this kid. Like all those kinds of things. Yeah, there's a lot of people like that. There's not a lot of people who won't travel except by horse and buggy.
Not only are there a lot of people like that, but there are few resources for people like that. And so Brighter Planet had an opportunity to become a major resource for a wide group of people that really didn't have anything else that was helping them in a meaningful way. And I think, you know, so that's kind of from the problem statement perspective, but also from the interface design perspective, one of the insights that came out of research with those moms was that the only time they really have for themselves to browse the web is when they're breastfeeding. And so they only have one hand to use their computer with. I mean, to hear people talk about that, you would never get that insight from your own intuition. You know, no designer, I don't care how smart you are, is sitting there drawing up a website and thinking to themselves, yeah, well, moms are probably going to use this breastfeeding. Like, no, you would never have intuited that. So doing that research and discovering that this needed to have a passive experience component to it so that people could browse one-handed using like the scroll wheel of their mouse and click on stuff but not type stuff in, I think completely transformed a lot of the functionality that we designed and built also.
Whitney, there's a couple questions here in the chat that I wanted to ask you. One most recent one from Luke Dorney. He says, do user experience people need to constantly redirect and maintain the direction of a project, or are they merely a stage of the project? In other words, are you involved typically from beginning to end, or do they bring you in at a certain point and then you're out?
It completely depends on the project, and it completely depends on the people. So I work on projects, like as Jeffrey said early on in the talk, that I kind of do two different types of projects. Some of my projects are with HappyCog or other agencies where it's really their project, their client, they're completely managing it, and I come in for a specific piece of that project, usually in the beginning. I'm totally involved in the whole thing, but I'm not producing, and I'm often not even present for the later stages. And that's still successful because user experience is at the core of everything that HappyCog does. And those people that work on HappyCog projects are all user experience designers, even if it's not in their title. So I don't have the least bit of worry when I roll off of a project in the later phases and it's in, you know, the dev phase or whatever. I don't worry that I need to be there like to carry it along and keep it on track. But I do have other clients where they're directly my clients and I'm being brought into their company either to bolster an existing team or to lead the entire redesign, in which I'm there from the day that they push go on the site to make it live and thereafter to ensure that if any usability issues pop up, you know, once it's live, that I'm there to address them. So it really depends on the type of company, their level of understanding, how much they value user experience, and also the resources that are on the project.
Does that ever become a stumbling block, though, if you don't have the opportunity, you know, if they are only going to be bringing you in for a week or for a certain block of time and you know, man, we're not going to get this all done? Or is it more open than that, usually, the kind of companies that bring you in?
Yeah, well, I am a consultant in the truest form. So my projects have start dates and end dates, and I have to try very hard to stay on schedule because I have other projects, you know, that come up soon after. So when I have an end date, it's important that I stick to it, and that can be a sticking point. So a great example of that is the Boxy beta project. So I was the user experience designer on the beta, which they released in December of 2009, but I only worked with them from December 2008 until May 2009. So between May and December of last year, I wasn't on the clock with them. And there were several months in there in which my wireframes were being adapted into visual designs. And I wasn't involved because I was on other projects, because they're a startup and they didn't have the funding to just have an open-ended assignment with me. Right. And that's totally, totally common, especially with startups. But no company is going to want to just pay at random if they don't know exactly what the schedule is going to be. And for Boxy in particular, they were a small, nimble team that was dealing with a lot of other issues beyond just the redesign for the beta. So the way that we worked it is that I was rolled off the project in May and didn't have a lot of involvement for the next few months. But then once they were getting closer to the beta, I was looped back in to review the designs, to make sure that everything, you know, had been executed according to plan. And I gave my feedback on a few areas where I felt that they could be improved, and then didn't know again what might happen. And when I saw the beta release, I was thrilled with what they had put together. And in many ways, I felt that they improved upon my designs. And that's the best possible outcome. But they were already a great team before I came along. So it wasn't much of a surprise. There have been other projects, though, and I won't name names, where I've been rolled off and then the thing launches and I don't recognize it. And none of the work that I did affected the outcome. And that's difficult, but that's just the life of a consultant, I suppose.
Here's another good question just coming in. Tim H. asks, in smaller teams or one-person environments, what's the most important user experience stuff we can do? And this was on my mind, too. What about the people who want to bring some aspect of user experience to a project, and maybe they don't have the title of user experience expert, but they want to do something? Are there tools that they can use, or are there tools that you use? What can you recommend to that kind of person who wants to try this or wants to learn?
Well, clearly Tim H. isn't attending an event apart. If he were attending, he would see my talk, DIY UX, Do-It-Yourself User Experience, in which I talk about four distinct activities that absolutely anyone can do, whether you are officially a user experience designer or not. And those four things are design research, web analytics, usability testing, and experimentation and iteration. So you can always find out more about your users. You can always test your designs. You can always look into the stats to see what people are doing. And you can always have that culture of experimentation and iteration, being willing to throw your designs away, being humble about the things that you create, and always wanting to improve upon things as you get that feedback and just have that continuous feedback loop. You can do it in more under the radar ways, even if your company doesn't really approve it or budget for it or even know about it. So search for DIY UX. My slides are online, or come to an event apart, Minneapolis or San Diego, 2010, I'll be reprising the same talks.
They are good talks, indeed. Is there anything online about that? Are there any articles or books about kind of doing your own UX?
There are lots. I include book recommendations in the slides, so I can send out the link after this, and you can post it up with the podcast or whatever. Or you
mean slideshare.net/Whitney Hess/DIY/UX?
There's some numbers after it. There's a more updated version online. But if you just go to, you know, SlideShare and search for Whitney Hess, you can see the latest version, which is from an event apart, Chicago, 2009.
And I'll make sure all these are in the show links, too, so that people going to the site can get all of these.
There are book recommendations there. The ones off the top of my head that I would recommend, especially for usability testing, because that's something that everybody can do. I don't care if you have a boss breathing down your neck and you have no time. You can go out on your lunch break and bring your designs to a coffee shop and do usability testing. Dana Chisnell and Jeffrey Rubin have the handbook guide to usability testing. I don't know the exact title, but that's a really great book that you can learn more about how to do that.
And Steve Krug's...
The latest book, Rocket Surgery. Yeah, that's also a great guide for usability testing. There are a lot of them out there. I don't think you need to know much, but figure out the four or five tasks that people absolutely have to be able to achieve on your site and go and get people to sit down with it and ask them one at a time, give them one task, and watch as they go through it and have them speak aloud as they're making decisions for where to click or where to look, why they did that, and see if they're able to do the things that they should be able to do. It's pretty straightforward.
Our friend Jared was on last week, as you know, and I think he said he defined usability testing as basically watch people using your stuff.
Yeah.
Watch people using your stuff and don't tell them what to do.
Yes, I can not tell them.
And I, you know, as a designer, I remember when I first started showing web stuff things that I'd designed to people who didn't get it, and I'd go like, no. The logo's the home button. That color change is really important because it's an effect. All that stuff. Yeah. So,
of course.
It's weird. I think it makes you a mature designer. I think no matter how talented you are, and I'm definitely not the most talented designer, but even really talented designers, there's a certain maturity that happens when you really work with the public that you're designing for, when you really interact with them and see how things work or fail. And if you don't have that opportunity, it kind of limits you, and it limits you to being a stylist, a decorator, there's lots of great talent that you can bring to bear without knowing anything about the user, but there'll be a limitation to what you can achieve as a designer if you're not really designing for people and you're not testing in that way.
Yeah, I would say let your talent be not the genius of pixel pushing, but the genius of listening well. And if you listen well, you can always improve upon what you've created, and you're going to create something better. And it's just a natural progression, and it never ends. You can never stop improving upon what you've created. And so long as you keep asking people the right questions and listening to what they say and accepting what they say, you're bound to create products that people want to use.
And when you say listening to people, you don't mean you're listening to people tell you how to solve a problem. You don't mean you're saying, do you like the blue nav or the red nav better? You're not doing that. You're not asking them to second guess the design. So what are you doing? What kind of questions are you asking? What are you listening for?
Okay. So yes, you never ask somebody to design it for you because that's your job. But you ask them if they can achieve X, Y, and Z. So show me how you would enter a new bank account. You give them a task and you watch them do that task. If we're not talking about usability testing and you're just getting to know people's problems, it's about asking about their behaviors and their needs, not about their likes and dislikes. So, how do you decorate for your party? Using open-ended questions that start with how or what or who or where, not questions that start with do so that they can answer it yes or no and then you don't get any information, or do you like this? That's a yes or no question. But open-ended questions like, how do you do this? And then they can describe to you all the activities that they go through. They can show you the things that they use to do this or that. Or who do you do this with? And you get a sense of the environment that they're in which they're doing the thing. That's when you can uncover, well, what are some of the pain points for them? So, if you were designing a new kitchen appliance, how do you prep for the recipe that you're cooking tonight? And they describe all of the things that they're doing. And then you start to see that things are piling up in this area. So maybe your appliance can relieve some of that pressure. I mean, those are the kinds of, you're trying to figure out, what are they doing? What are they needing to be better? And that really is ultimately what helps you create a product that fits easily into their lives, as opposed to creating something that's going to be a stretch for them or is going to be unnatural for them to use. And that's how you can ensure that you've wasted your time in building something that's useless to people.
That's really great advice. We have to end there. We've hit our time limit, but this was a great one. I really appreciate you being on the show, Whitney.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. Thank you for the great questions, both of you.
Thanks again to my co-host, Jeffrey Zeldman, and thanks to our special guest, Whitney Hess. Thanks also to our sponsor, MailChimp.com, for making this show possible. And thanks to you for listening. Now you can directly help support 5x5 and your favorite shows by becoming a member and get a cool t-shirt in the process. Go to members.5x5.tv to learn more. This is Dan Benjamin for The Big Web Show. We'll see you again next week.